Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Jury duty is your civic duty as an American. When you report for service, you never know what kind of case you'll get. Maybe it'll be Lindsay Lohan or Casey Anthony. Or maybe it'll be a huge patent law case filled with technical jargon, 20 pages of jury forms, and billions of dollars riding on the verdict. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Viglund in for Kai Rizdahl, and this is your Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 21st day of August. After weeks of juicy testimony, assuming you call patent law juicy, Silicon Valley's trial of the century, or of the moment anyway, is about to head to the jury. Apple is suing Samsung for allegedly copying the design of its iPhone and iPads. Samsung is suing Apple back for allegedly infringing on its mobile patents. So why should we care who wins this $2.5 billion battle? Here's Marketplace's Quina Kim.
Like most patent trials, even the simplest questions in Apple versus Samsung are complicated. Take this one. How will the verdict affect consumers? Cal Rustiala is a law professor at UCLA and the author of The Knockoff Economy.
There's a lot of different claims, and winning and losing can go in different directions.
Rustiala doesn't see a winner-take-all scenario, but he says, let's assume the jury finds that Samsung copied the rectangular-shaped and curved edges of the iPad and iPhone. That verdict would force competitors to change the shape of their products.
We might see some crazy designs.
But if consumers demand a rectangular shape, Apple could levy a licensing fee to every manufacturer who wants to meet that demand. And who will pay those fees? Sarah Rotman Epps is an analyst at Forrester.
Those costs will trickle down to consumers.
And if Samsung wins its patent claims, well then, Samsung could charge Apple a fee for using its patents for wireless technology and camera phones. Rotman Epps adds that if Samsung wins, we'll see even more products copying Apple. And that's prompted concerns that a Samsung victory could stifle innovation. But James Allworth, who writes about innovation at the Harvard Business Review, isn't buying it.
The assumption that a lot of people have is that without patent protection, companies will not invest in them.
But Apple became the most valuable company in the world yesterday. And Allworth says, even if copycats flood the market, Apple will just innovate faster. I'm Quina Kim for Marketplace.
If you own an Apple product, you might be interested in knowing how Apple's supply chain is doing. 6 months ago, the Fair Labor Association, a group hired by Apple, found a number of problems with Chinese iPhone and iPad maker Foxconn. Those issues included too much overtime, unsafe working conditions, and more. Today, the Fair Labor Association released an update on whether Foxconn is complying with a series of recommendations it made. Our China correspondent Rob Schmitz has the latest.
Foxconn is at the top of the manufacturing pyramid. The company's very good at getting things done, pushed, of course, by profit. But how good has Foxconn been at implementing hundreds of action items to improve conditions for its workers? Arat van Heerden is president and CEO of the Fair Labor Association. He routinely visits Foxconn factories for an ongoing audit of the company's work practices.
Frankly, the speed with which they've implemented this program is really precedent-setting.
He says the company has made changes to its factories, improving worker health and safety, modifying equipment, and giving more breaks. Back in February, Van Heerden discovered that only 1% of Foxconn's workers were enrolled in the government's unemployment insurance program. That's because migrant workers can't claim these benefits in their home province. Van Heerden says Foxconn persuaded the city government of Shenzhen, where the company's biggest factory is, to change this policy.
Millions of migrant workers in Shenzhen will now benefit from that new access. And I think will be a template for other provinces to follow.
But not everyone's convinced. China Labor Bulletin's Jeffrey Crothell advocates for factory workers.
It's very encouraging that Foxconn is on board and following through with what the FLA has asked it to do. But, you know, I always judge things on how they appear in practice.
The Fair Labor Association will soon have a front-row seat when Foxconn ramps up production for Apple's new iPhone. Van Heerden says a number of big companies have asked him how Foxconn will limit overtime during this ramp-up season. If Foxconn is able to do it, he says, other companies will likely follow. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
And you can check out a video of what Rob saw when he went inside the Foxconn factory a few months ago. Go to marketplace.org and click on Apple Economy. Most of us have gotten used to checking online to find the best travel deals. But when it comes to hotel prices, some of those so-called deals may be less of a bargain than you thought. Consumers have filed a price-fixing lawsuit against some of the world's biggest hotel chains and online travel sites, Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
Online travel sites like Expedia and Travelocity market themselves as the best sources for the cheapest hotel rooms.
If they'd booked with Travelocity, they could be paying less for the same room.
Lawyer Steve Berman takes issue with such ads.
When you get online and you see an ad from Expedia or Travelocity that says best price or lowest price, that's false. It is an agreed price. No one is competing on price because they've all agreed that they won't.
Berman represents consumers in a lawsuit against online brokers like Expedia and Travelocity and big hotel chains like Hilton and Sheraton. The suit alleges the travel sites colluded with hotels to fix the prices for online room reservations. A similar case is ongoing in England.
In Europe, Expedia has already admitted that it engaged in illegal behavior and is cooperating with the authorities in exchange for leniency.
How does the alleged price fixing work? Dorian Harris runs a discount hotel booking agency called Skoosh. Companies like his buy hotel rooms from wholesalers at a discount. But when Harris tried to pass along that discount to consumers, hotels contacted his company and pressured it to raise rates.
They would say to us, we're selling at 100, Expedia is selling at 100, you either sell us at 100 or not at all.
Neither Hilton Hotels nor Expedia responded to an interview request by Showtime. In a written statement, Travelocity denies that it has engaged in any anti-competitive actions. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, the S&P 500 hit a four-year high earlier today, but then fell back before the close. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Last month, when the city attorney's office here in Los Angeles sued U.S. Bank over foreclosures that had been abandoned and left to rot, it reminded us just how long we've been in this mess and how damaging it's been to communities all over the United States. I can't tell you how many reports we've done on the foreclosure story, how many homeowners we've talked to and banks and politicians, how many solutions have been proposed and ignored. 4 or 5 years after the bubble popped, the narrative hasn't changed much. But today, a perspective that maybe you haven't heard before, from Officer Eric Young of the LAPD Southeast Division.
Yeah, I'm going to go to the east side of the division, which is north of Imperial Highway and east of Wilmington Avenue. So.
We're heading out on a tour of what the foreclosure crisis has wrought in Watts, an area of Los Angeles infamous for riots and gangs, and these days, boarded up vacant homes.
So as we head over there... Mm-hmm. Talk us through what you have seen over the last 4 years as the housing bust has hit this division.
You know, several years ago, property crimes took a back seat to all the violent crime we had. But now, as our violent crime goes down, the department, the city, we're focusing more on our property crimes.
Property crimes. That's burglary, trespassing, vandalism. All hallmarks of the housing crisis. There were more than 1,500 foreclosure actions over the last year in a single zip code here, according to RealtyTrack. And before we arrive at that zip code, a warning.
You know, I'm not going to be doing any traffic stops or anything like that with you guys in the car. For safety reasons, though, if anything happens, just push this orange button on my radio. If I can't do that, this little orange button right here, yep. And they'll find us, okay?
Officer Young has served in Southeast Division for 12 years. His area of responsibility is the smallest in size, highest in crime. But it's the evolution in the type of crime he battles that brought us to this ride-along.
4 years ago, I'd say about 3 years ago, it was probably at its worst. On any given day, I'd probably have 45, 50 vacant homes in my area.
There's your record.
There are 68 documented criminal street gangs in LAPD Southeast Division. Because of the foreclosure crisis, those gangs and the area's homeless population have a whole lot more housing to choose from.
This is an interesting place right here. It sat vacant for about 2.5, 3 years. There was a homicide in that garage that went unnoticed for quite some time.
Quite some time?
Probably a couple weeks before we got to it.
2 weeks?
Probably. It was pretty much based on the smell that it created. So we're going to park the car right here.
We parked in front of a boarded-up split-level house fronted by a wire fence with a big hole cut out of it. This property on Kalmaya Street in Watts is in foreclosure. 2,300 square feet, list value $115,000 on the real estate website Redfin.
As of this morning, these homes are owned by J.P. Morgan. And
how long have they been unoccupied?
3 years at least.
3 years?
At least, yes. Hey, how you doing, bud?
Pretty good.
Hey, who you with?
Turned out that morning, a crew from Field Asset Services turned up at the house. FAS is contracted by banks to send cleanup crews to abandoned properties all over the country. William Perez was the crew chief for this job on Kalmaya.
I started 3 years ago, and my cousin told me there would be 6 days a week, 80 hours a week. I laughed at him. Oh, come on. You're not serious. 6 days a week, 80 hours a week. That's what we got. People say it'll slow down, but with the amount of houses that are on foreclosure already, I'll be working for the next 2 years straight. Hello? Hey, Ben. Yeah, I don't know if I can finish it today because there's a lot. There's, I think, 60 cubes.
60 cubes is 60 cubic yards of trash on this property.
Be super careful where you step, guys. But this is typical of what you'll find in a vacant home around here. This is very typical.
Officer Young made his way to the back, to a garage strewn with filthy mattresses and drug paraphernalia and plastered in graffiti.
Okay, the gang took it over. This is Fudgetown Mafia Crips. I mean, that's their gang sign, you know. So they were here first. And then come the people, the homeless people, you know, the narcotics users. And this is good dig. I mean, you know, you got four walls and a roof. Living large.
In this particular property in Watts, we've had crews out at the property on average once a week for the past 4 months.
Gary Kishner is a spokesman for J.P. Morgan Chase.
And unfortunately, at this particular property, individuals in the community have been dumping.
Broken beer bottles and baby cribs, old toys, dirty clothes, over and over again. Jenny Schutz has researched the effects of the housing crisis for the USC Price School of Public Policy. She says banks are loan providers, not landlords, and simply aren't equipped to handle the maintenance on millions of empty foreclosures.
They don't want to be maintaining the lawns, they don't want to be doing the exterior maintenance, doing security, and they also haven't been able to sell them and get them out of the inventory because we have such a glut at this point.
Hey.
All of that is, quite frankly, irrelevant to the people living near these blighted homes, whether they're in multi-million dollar subdivisions or far down the economic scale here in Watts.
That means people are going over there to the vacant property, they urinate and trash.
48-year-old Elaine Brown came out of her home across the street. She's lived here since March.
And you know, I could come home late at night. I don't know, and it's so dark over there. I can't see, you know, when I'm coming home, who's over there, who could come out of there and jump out on me.
So who do you blame for this situation?
I blame the banks. Bottom line, I blame the banks.
What do you think they should have to do?
Really, to be honest with you, because it's moving too slow for a buyer, tear it down. Tear it down, and that's it.
If you'd like to see some photos of the house on Kalmaya Street and Officer Young, they're at marketplace.org. Coming up, a closer look at executive compensation.
The difference between the CEOs and everybody else is that the CEOs pick the people who set their pay.
But first, let's do the numbers. After a couple of days just hanging around, the market started strong but fell in the end. The Dow dropped 68 points, 0.5%, to finish at 13,203. The Nasdaq was off 8 points, 0.3% at 3,067. And the S&P 500 was down 4 points, 0.3% to end at 1413. Coal mining stocks were stoked after a federal court rejected an EPA rule limiting air pollutants that blow across state lines. Utilities would have had to close older coal-burning plants. Peabody Energy, which supplies coal that generates 10% of the nation's electricity, rose 0.3%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note slipped to 1.8%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
on the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The National Association of Realtors releases its monthly existing home sales report for July. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention 2012 National Cancer Conference continues in Washington. And more than 900 quilts are on exhibit in Grand Rapids, Michigan, at an event organized by the American Quilter Society. Works from Japan and Egypt are featured. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. Today, several human rights groups and aid organizations called on the United Nations Security Council to do something about the growing humanitarian crisis in Syria. They warned 1.5 million Syrians are now displaced within their own country, cut off from the basics of food and medical care. Continued fighting in Aleppo and other cities have devastated Syria, but it's also causing serious economic problems in parts of its northern neighbor, Turkey. Reese Ehrlich reports from near the Syrian border.
The owner of a local trucking firm walks up the stone stairway of his almost empty office building. Ali Özdemir says business was booming until 6 months ago. His company ferried Turkish goods through Syria and on to Lebanon and Jordan. 400 trucks per day flowed back and forth. Then, last November, someone inside Syria shot up his trucks.
Our trucks is a little bit damaged, but other companies' trucks was extremely damaged.
Not enough security on the road.
There is no security.
Özdemir says the Syrian military attacked his and other trucks in retaliation for Turkish government support for Syrian rebels. Mutual recriminations ended cross-border trade. Özdemir says the result is a mini depression here in Antakya.
We are the nearest place to Syria, and the trade exchange, it was very, very big between Antakya and Syria. But after the war has started, it's stopped.
Like most Turks, Özdemir supports the Syrian opposition and hopes Syrian President Bashar al-Assad will be overthrown soon.
No, I don't think Assad will stay in the president after what he did.
But some Turkish business people have a different opinion. On Antakya's main shopping street, many store owners talk of the stability Assad brought to Syria. They remember fondly the thousands of affluent Syrian tourists who come here, buy their stuff, and fill up local restaurants. Now, these visitors are just a memory. Clothing store owner Mohammed Helu puts some T-shirts in a plastic bag, one of his few sales today. He blames his economic troubles on the Turkish government's support for the rebels.
I don't like the Turkish policy because my business has gone down. I'm not saying I'm pro or anti-Assad. By backing the rebels, trade with Syria has stopped, and so has my business.
But not all business people are suffering because of the upheaval in Syria. Gizam Moral opens the door to her medical supply company in Antakya. She says business is booming as people buy medical supplies and then smuggle them over the border to help the Syrian rebels. Oral says Turkish hospitals and foreign aid groups are also buying huge quantities of supplies to help some 60,000 refugees who have flooded into Turkey.
Last year, we just working with government hospital and with pharmacies, and that's all. But now, there are lots of people coming here to Antakya to buy some things. If you compare last year, it's doing better.
Better in terms of business, at least. But Oral wishes the fighting in neighboring Syria would stop. She fears Syria's ethnic and religious conflicts could spill over to Antakya.
We are living in here like Sunni, Christian people, Jewish people. We are all living together. We are afraid to this situation.
Fear is palpable here, fear for personal safety and fear for the health of an economy that has always depended on the free flow of peoples between Syria and Turkey. In Antakya, I'm Reese Ehrlich for Marketplace.
This week, we're exploring how much we get paid in America and why.
The American dream.
Millionaires, billionaires.
Class warfare.
Paycheck to paycheck.
We pay our fair share.
The payday for one group of workers tends to get a lot of attention. Company bosses. Now, that's partly because we know what they make. Public companies can't keep their compensation a secret. But now Congress is demanding companies go further and compare CEO pay to what everyone else makes at a company. Now, that has sparked some controversy throughout the corporate sector, with the exception of the man who helped dream up the idea. Marketplace's David Brancaccio has today's story in our series, Payday.
This is the story of an idea that took decades to formulate and percolate. It took so long that you have to adjust for inflation. When James Cotton says millions, think tens of millions.
You're working with this guy, and he seems to be pretty intelligent, but dang, he doesn't look like he's worth $2 million a year.
Cotton is now 72, but in the 1970s, he was a corporate lawyer at IBM, where he dealt with financial statements. So in an occupation full of price-to-earnings ratios.
That's how it really got started in my head.
Cotton came up with his own ratio. Take the CEO's compensation and divide by the average of everyone else's pay at the company. If the CEO makes $20 million a year and everyone else averages $100,000, then that's a 200-to-1 ratio. The bigger the ratio, the wider the gulf between the boss and everyone else.
The top executives earn a significant amount of money, and they're people who are manufacturing the actual machine that's providing this money and are not making nearly as much money. And I thought about it, and I said, you know, there's something wrong with this situation.
It was Cotton's thought that the government should force public companies to calculate and report this ratio. He later left IBM to become a law professor at Texas Southern. In 1997, he published his case for a pay ratio in a law review, hoping it would attract attention.
And maybe somebody would pick it up and see the significance of it. And nobody did until you came along.
Well, wait, I want to understand this. So, like, I'm the first guy to call about this?
Yeah.
I had called bearing the news that 2 years ago, Congress put a ratio very much like Cotton's into the big financial reform law called Dodd-Frank.
You know, I keep track of financial business and stuff. You have to remember, I have this low vision. I'm legally blind, so it's very hard to read things. But that is great news if it's actually in the statute.
It is, but I have to temper that news with the fact that the SEC has been taking a while to try to implement this ratio. Because companies are very resistant to this.
Yes, I know how resistant they are.
So until the Securities and Exchange Commission determines the rules, public companies don't have to cough up the ratio, law or no law.
Yeah, the companies went ape over that.
Nell Minow at GMI Ratings is a fierce critic of outsized CEO pay. She says companies are terrified they'll get ranked and the ones with the biggest gap will face public shame. So there's a fight. In part about how to do the calculation.
What I think is hilarious is these people who keep telling you how much they know about finances and numbers have been arguing that they don't know how to do the math to get the answer on that.
Bill George, the former CEO of Medtronic, is now at the Harvard Business School. He's also on the boards of several companies you've heard of, including Goldman Sachs and ExxonMobil. He says a wide gulf between the pay of the CEO and everyone else can sow internal tension, which can hobble a company.
And if it gets out of alignment where all of a sudden a CEO is making huge multiples of what everyone else is, then you start to lose trust.
But he believes pay ratios are unfair because they make certain kinds of companies look bad for reasons that may have nothing to do with an overpaid boss. A supermarket chain might have an alarming-looking ratio because it's comparing the CEO to all the low-wage checkout clerks, typical of this sort of company.
I think it's very hard to legislate compensation. I don't think that's going to get there.
Instead, he says you keep executive pay in line by getting the board of directors to stand up to the boss, which doesn't always happen.
And a lot of people just back off to the CEO and let the CEO influence compensation, and that's wrong.
And the difference between the CEOs and everybody else is that the CEOs pick the people who set their pay.
Nell Minow says, look around a boardroom when that pay is on the table.
We'll see. There's the CEO's golf buddy. There's the guy who's on the charitable board with him. These are not exactly arm's-length transactions, or if they are, the arms are very, very short.
Having your own posse decide what you get paid is a luxury that much of the rest of the workforce does not enjoy. Tomorrow in our series, Payday, a look at how paychecks get determined for the rest of us. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio for Marketplace.
And it turns out that very few companies have figured out how to compute the ratio of the CEO's pay to their rank and file. Check out David's post about those companies at marketplace.org. And before we leave the subject of compensation, yesterday we asked you, is it taboo or okay to tell all when it comes to talking about your salary? Do you share your paycheck details with family and friends and coworkers? Well, here's what some of you had to say.
It leads to jealousy, resentment, or pity, none of which are good between friends or coworkers.
As the wife of a teacher, it doesn't bother me the slightest for anyone to know what we live off of. Frankly, I feel it should embarrass them. I don't bring it up, but I don't hide it.
I have never seen anything good come out of knowing what your coworkers make.
I'd like some more openness on the topic. It's often the only way to discover just how much more male colleagues are being paid to do the same work.
I really don't feel any need to disclose my income to anyone. It's really none of their business.
Those were Facebook posts and tweets from Daniel Noto, Jess Hauk, a listener at an employment agency in New Jersey, Andrea Kareem, and Kyle Fletcher Baker, all read by Marketplace staffers. Tell us what you think about our paycheck series. We're on Facebook and Twitter and at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, each year Beloit College in Wisconsin conducts an admittedly unscientific survey it calls the Mindset List. It's a compendium of cultural references targeted at professors who may not realize just how out of it they seem to this year's college freshmen. Well, among the list's findings, when the class of 2016 thinks of Robert De Niro, it thinks not of Vito Corleone, but of the father-in-law in Meet the Fockers. And they probably have never seen an actual airplane ticket. Worst of all, quote, having grown up with MP3s and iPods, they never listen to music on the car radio and really have no use for radio at all. Whatevs. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 68 points, 0.5%. The Nasdaq fell 8 points, 0.3%. And the S&P 500 lost 4 points, 0.3%. Thanks to Mary Dew and Justin Ho on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Haas and Rod Abid. I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us again tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.